Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Three prominent Republicans are duking it out in the battle to replace Congressman Duncan Hunter, and several more have dropped out of the race. We'll have the latest developments on today's show. Senator Elizabeth Warren, a leading Democratic presidential contender, is coming to San Diego on October 3rd. Hear how you can get tickets. And in Washington, House Democrats have launched an impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. We'll have a special report on the evidence known so far, including audio of the complete whistleblower complaint that everybody's been talking about. We'll also have an update on La Mesa's efforts to provide citizen oversight of police, a flour recall due to E. coli, a settlement to stave off a strike of Kaiser healthcare workers, and why sexual predator Alvin Quarles won't be released anytime soon. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. The weather in El Cajon Thursday morning was cloudy and drizzling rain, but the political rhetoric was sweltering. Daryl Issa, who retired from the 49th Congressional District, announced that he is running for the 50th Congressional District seat held by Duncan Hunter. Four other Republican candidates announced they have withdrawn from the race and endorsed Issa. They are El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells, former Escondido Mayor Sam Abed, former Navy SEAL Commander Larry Wilski, and Temecula Councilman Matt Ron. Another candidate, former San Diego City Councilman and conservative radio host Carl DeMaio, held a rival press conference about 100 feet away to attack Issa. State Senator Brian Jones, who also announced he's running, chose to remain above the fray by staying away. Issa said the exploratory committee, which he established a few weeks ago, has received over 2,400 contributions. He says he's running because, quote, "I believe I have the history, the skills, the seniority, and the capability to hit the ground running, not just for this district, but for California." And he pledged to help Republicans retake control of Congress. Until last week, Issa was nominated by President Trump to lead the U.S. Trade and Development Agency, but a Senate committee held up Issa's confirmation due to concerns over material in his FBI background check. The contents of that file have not been made public, but Issa claims there's nothing in it not already in his Wikipedia file. Wikipedia cites investigations by major newspapers that reported on allegations which said while in the Army decades ago, Issa received a bad conduct rating and a demotion after being accused of car theft. He was later suspected of an arson fire at a building that he owned. The announcement from the former nine-term congressman immediately shakes up the race to replace embattled Duncan Hunter, who is scheduled to go on trial in January on 60 counts of federal corruption. Hunter is accused of spending over $250,000 in campaign funds on a lavish personal lifestyle and then falsifying campaign expenditure reports to cover up the thefts. Although Hunter has pleaded not guilty to those charges, even many supporters say he could lose the election to Democratic challenger Amar Campanajar, who came within 3 points of beating Hunter in 2018. Campanajar is running again for this seat in the March 2020 primary, well-funded in a race that Democrats view as a potential pickup seat. Independent candidate Helen Horvath is also in this race. Mayor Wells praised Issa as an iconic conservative, adding that Issa shares his concerns over issues such as homelessness facing cities. Abed stressed border security concerns, and Wilski talked about veterans' issues as common goals when they announced their support for Issa, who also got the backing of Supervisor Diane Jacob. Issa launched numerous investigations into the Obama administration when he chaired the House Committee on Oversight and Reform, and he told the crowd that if he's elected, his seniority will make him the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee. DeMaio supporters interrupted Issa's press conference with loud chanting, and some former Issa constituents held up signs reading, "Issa left us." DeMaio characterizes the race as a battle between the politicians and the people, and then took swipes at both Hunter and Issa. "It's a clear distinction about politicians who have been on the take, politicians who seek position, politicians who give up the fight, and who are quitting on California," said DeMaio. He also cited his record of leading efforts to cut taxes and promised to fight for voters against what he called democratic socialism. Diane Harkey, a Republican candidate who ran and lost in the 49th District after Issa resigned, issued a statement calling him a quitter who neglected his own constituents for years and cost us a once reliably Republican congressional district. Her written statement also accuses Issa of raising over $1 million for his campaign and then transferring that money to his personal checking account after he left office. The pugnacious DeMaio also took aim squarely at Hunter. "Shame on the Republican Party for not taking out the trash," he said. "It is time for Mr. Hunter to resign and give this district a fresh start." Issa took a more subtle approach, calling Hunter's situation regrettable. He said while Hunter deserves his day in court, the district deserves a member who can hold on to the district in the 2020 election and, frankly, show up to vote. Hunter is barred from serving on any committees while his trial is pending. Now, neither Issa nor DeMaio actually live in the 50th Congressional District. Federal law does not have a residency requirement to represent a congressional district. However, critics have faulted the pair as carpetbaggers who lack roots in the district or familiarity with its issues. Earlier this week, Senator Brian Jones announced that he, too, will seek election to Hunter's seat. His press release notes that he is now the only candidate with roots in the district, a proven conservative track record, and the ability to get things done. He says, "I grew up here and have represented the people of this district as a Santee City Council member, state assemblyman, and now as a state senator." He touts his conservative voting record in Sacramento, where he has also worked across the aisle to get 23 measures that he sponsored signed into law in a legislature controlled by Democrats. Jones cites his faith-based principles and record in Santee and the city's thriving development and low taxes. Asked why he didn't hold his own event in downtown Ocahon alongside Issa and DeMaio's dueling press conferences, Jones laughed and then quipped, "Why am I going to show up at a campaign event which is in the boundaries of Congresswoman Susan Davis' district?" And he's right. El Cajon is split between the 50th and 53rd districts, and El Cajon Centennial Plaza lies squarely in the 53rd, not the district that DeMaio and Issa say they are running to represent. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, a top-tier Democratic presidential candidate, will hold an outdoor town hall in San Diego on Thursday, October 3rd at 7 p.m., in Waterfront Park, next to the County Administration Building. The event, her first visit to San Diego County as a candidate, is part of a Western swing, which includes visits to Nevada and Los Angeles. Her visit comes as poll numbers are surging for Warren. A new poll by CNN and the Des Moines Register, Iowa's largest newspaper, puts Warren in the lead by 2 points over former Vice President Joe Biden, with a healthy lead over other challengers as well. An MSNBC poll also has Warren leading Biden by 2 points in Iowa, a key early caucus state. A poll by Quinnipiac University puts Warren in the lead nationwide by 2 points, though Biden retains his lead nationally in some other polls. Major polls also show Warren consistently ahead of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who has visited San Diego several times during his presidential campaigns. Warren was raised in Oklahoma in a middle-class family that struggled after her father had a heart attack, and her mother took a minimum wage job to make ends meet. She overcame these hardships to become a teacher and later taught law at Harvard University. As a senator and special advisor to the Secretary of the Treasury under President Barack Obama, Warren led efforts that established the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The agency protects consumers against predatory practices by banks, credit card companies, and other financial institutions. According to her website, Warren is running on a platform of ending corruption in Washington, rebuilding the middle class, strengthening our democracy, equal justice under the law, and a foreign policy for all. If you would like to attend her October 3rd town hall in San Diego, you can RSVP through the event section on her website at elizabethwarren.com. Reporting for KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This is Miriam Raftery with a special report on the impeachment proceedings announced this week against President Donald Trump. A whistleblower complaint against President Trump that triggered the impeachment effort has been declassified and just released to the public. That report also implicates Attorney General William Barr and the president's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. We'll be airing a reading of the whistleblower complaint in its entirety at the end of this special report. The complaint states that the president abused his power during a July 25th phone call, pressuring the Ukraine's president to investigate the son of former Vice President Joe Biden, Trump's political rival, in an effort to influence the 2020 election. The whistleblower, whom the New York Times reports is a CIA agent assigned to the White House, also alleges that Trump tried to hide his actions by locking up records of the call. The Washington Post reports that just 1 week before that call to the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, Trump ordered a halt to military aid promised to the Ukraine. Withholding that military aid for Ukraine also aided Russia, since the Ukraine wanted weapons, such as anti-tank missiles, to fight back against neighboring Russian-backed forces. White House and intelligence officials were reportedly left in the dark as to why the president ordered a block on delivery of that critical military aid to Ukraine. The Trump administration's own intelligence community Inspector General Michael Atkinson warned that the whistleblower complaints are both credible and an urgent concern that, in his words, raises serious national intelligence and security risks for the United States. This week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that House Democrats will launch a formal impeachment inquiry over the allegations. Speaker Pelosi says the actions taken to date by the president have seriously violated the Constitution. She adds that the president must be held accountable, adding, "No one is above the law." After the unredacted transcript was declassified and further details were revealed, Pelosi stated, "This is a cover-up." Trump has denied wrongdoing. He first said he made no effort to pressure Zelensky over Biden's son. He denounced the impeachment inquiry as presidential harassment and witch-hunt garbage in a series of Twitter posts. But even a summary of the call finally released by the White House confirms that Trump did push the Ukrainian leader to investigate Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who worked for a Ukrainian oil company, for corruption, even though a prior investigation by the Ukraine found no wrongdoing by Hunter Biden, the Ukrainian prosecutor has confirmed. Now, according to that White House transcript summary, Trump told Zelensky, "There's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution. And a lot of people want to find out about that, so whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution, so if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me," Trump stated, according to the official White House summary. Zelensky then assured Trump that he would have control over the next prosecutor. Trump also pushed Zelensky to work with Attorney General Barr and to meet Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. The summary, which resembles a transcript, is reportedly some 19 minutes shorter than the length of the actual phone call, leading to questions over just what was left out. Trump has been documented at least 4 times in the past, altering transcripts on issues ranging from his conversations with Vladimir Putin, Russia's president, to his golf scores. The president later made a veiled threat against whoever leaked information to the whistleblower, the Washington Post reports. At a private United Nations event, caught on tape by the Los Angeles Times, Trump said he wants to know who gave the whistleblower information because, quote, "That's close to a spy."
"Who's the person that gave the whistleblower the information? Because that's close to a spy. You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right? The spies and treason, right? We used to handle it a little differently than we do now."
Treason, according to the Constitution, is punishable by death. Besides the phone call between Trump and Zelensky, the whistleblower also details an extensive history involving both Attorney General Barr and Trump's lawyer Giuliani to persuade Ukrainian officials to aid Trump by undermining U.S. elections. Former Republican National Committee spokesman Tim Miller has broken ranks with his party to denounce Trump's action and defend Biden's. In an editorial, Miller explains that Biden's son was doing consulting work for Burisma, a Ukrainian oil company under investigation for corruption. Vice President Biden, along with European allies and U.S. diplomats, all called on the prosecutor to be fired so that corrupt oligarchs could be investigated more aggressively, Miller explains. He points out that Biden called for a deeper investigation by the Ukraine into the oligarch running the company that Biden's son worked for as a consultant. Miller concludes, quote, "Donald Trump was allegedly pressuring the Ukrainian government to investigate a domestic political foe on a bogus conspiracy for personal gain. Joe Biden was pressuring the Ukrainian government to root out corruption in their own country and bring about democratic reforms." The former Republican National Committee spokesman, who also served as communications director for Jeb Bush, concludes that the president's effort to pressure the Ukraine's president for political gain is not a game, adding, "Sometimes things are cut and dry. Sometimes one man is fighting corruption, and the other guy is corrupting all of us on purpose. This is one of those times." Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, a Republican running against Trump in the primary, went even further. Talk about pressuring a foreign country to interfere with and control a U.S. election? It couldn't be clearer, Weld said in an interview on MSNBC. And that's not just undermining democratic institutions, he adds. It's treason, pure and simple. Some constitutional experts disagree with Weld on that point, since the Constitution defines treason narrowly as levying war against the U.S. or adhering to our enemies, giving them aid and comfort. But Trump's action could meet the standard for high crimes that are impeachable offenses. Some other Republicans have circled the wagons to support Trump. San Diego Congressman Duncan Hunter released a statement denouncing the impeachment inquiry as not based on any evidence or facts, adding, "Democrats know that the Senate will not convict this president," and accused Democrats of launching impeachment efforts for their political gain. Hunter, long a staunch Trump supporter, is currently under indictment for 60 federal counts of corruption. If convicted, a presidential pardon could be his only recourse to avoid prison. But he's not the only prominent Republican locally to slam Democrats for the impeachment effort. Retired Congressman Daryl Issa, who on Thursday announced he is running against Hunter, denounced Democrats' impeachment efforts as treacherous. Conservative talk show host Carl DeMaio, who's also running for Hunter's seat, says, "The only abuse of power I see in Washington today are the continual witch hunts," adding, "I've seen no impeachable offense by the president." Meanwhile, support for impeachment is growing among Democrats and the American public. The charges against Trump of pressuring a foreign power to influence a U.S. election also parallel allegations that Trump's campaign solicited help from Russia to defeat Hillary Clinton back in 2016, which was the focus of Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller's investigation. San Diego Congresswoman Susan Davis this week announced her support for the impeachment inquiry, citing the president's disregard for checks and balances as well as normal practices and protocols. And she adds, "To not move forward would make Congress complicit in the president's behavior. The president admitted he made a call, leveraging the power of his office to get what he wanted from a head of state," Congresswoman Davis concludes. CNN reports that a majority of the House of Representatives members now support an impeachment inquiry. A Newsweek poll finds that a majority of Americans also support impeaching Trump if he suspended military aid to Ukraine to pressure the foreign nation to investigate former Vice President Biden and his son. 44% of those polled said they'd strongly support removing Trump if the allegations are true, while another 11% said they'd somewhat support it. That's 55% total. Only 20% said they would strongly oppose impeaching Trump for such an action, and 6% said they would somewhat oppose impeachment. Others had no opinion yet. An impeachment inquiry does not necessarily mean that an impeachment vote will be held, depending on what else investigations now being conducted by House committees find. If the House does vote to impeach, the Senate would then hold an impeachment trial to determine whether or not President Trump should be removed from office. While the House is controlled by Democrats, the Senate is controlled by Republicans, making the odds against a conviction even higher, since it would require a two-thirds supermajority. Impeachment carries some political risk for Democrats. If the Senate were to vote against ousting Trump and he claims vindication, galvanizing his base to turn out and vote out Democrats. Not acting, however, risks alienating Democrats' own base. No president in U.S. history has ever actually been removed from office through an impeachment trial, although both Presidents Bill Clinton and Andrew Johnson were impeached by the House and later exonerated by the Senate. Richard Nixon resigned from office in 1975 after high-ranking members of his own party advised him that he faced impeachment if he did not resign. That was after tapes proved his involvement in the Watergate scandal. There are parallels to Watergate, which involved Republican operatives breaking into Democratic Party headquarters to influence the outcome of an election, prompting comparisons and images going viral on social media between Trump and Nixon, the last president to leave office midterm due to an impeachment threat. The main difference between the Watergate scandal and the Trump impeachment issues is that this time a foreign government is involved. Next up, to give you unfiltered information to make up your own mind on this important matter, we provide you with a reading of an audio tape of the entire, unredacted, declassified whistleblower complaint filed by a U.S. intelligence agency's whistleblower inside the White House.
Unclassified. August 12, 2019. The Honorable Richard Burr, Chairman, Select Committee on Intelligence, United States Senate. The Honorable Adam Schiff, Chairman, Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, United States House of Representatives. Dear Chairman Burr and Chairman Schiff, I'm reporting an urgent concern in accordance with the procedures outlined in 50 U.S.C. 3033-K5A. This letter is unclassified when separated from the attachment. In the course of my official duties, I've received information from multiple U.S. government officials that the President of the United States is using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the 2020 U.S. election. This interference includes, among other things, pressuring a foreign country to investigate one of the president's main domestic political rivals. The president's personal lawyer, Mr. Rudolph Giuliani, is a central figure in this effort. Attorney General Barr appears to be involved as well. Over the past 4 months, more than half a dozen U.S. officials have informed me of various facts related to this effort. The information provided herein was relayed to me in the course of official interagency business. It is routine for U.S. officials with responsibility for a particular regional or functional portfolio to share such information with one another in order to inform policymaking and analysis. I was not a direct witness to most of the events described. However, I found my colleagues' accounts of these events to be credible, because in almost all cases, multiple officials recounted fact patterns that were consistent with one another. In addition, a variety of information consistent with these private accounts has been reported publicly. I am deeply concerned that the actions described below constitute a serious or flagrant problem, abuse, or violation of law or executive order that does not include differences of opinions concerning public policy matters, consistent with the definition of an urgent concern in 50 U.S.C. 3033-K5G. I am therefore fulfilling my duty to report this information through proper legal channels to the relevant authorities. I am also concerned that these actions pose risks to U.S. national security and undermine the U.S. government's efforts to deter and counter foreign interference in U.S. elections. To the best of my knowledge, the entirety of this statement is unclassified when separated from the classified enclosure. I have endeavored to apply the classification standards outlined in Executive Order 13526 and to separate out information that I know or have reason to believe is classified for national security purposes. If a classification marking is applied retroactively, I believe it is incumbent upon the classifying authority to explain why such a marking was applied and to which specific information it pertains. 1. The 25 July presidential phone call. Early in the morning of 25 July, the president spoke by telephone with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. I do not know which side initiated the call. This was the first publicly acknowledged call between the two leaders since a brief congratulatory call after Mr. Zelensky won the presidency on 21 April. Multiple White House officials with direct knowledge of the call informed me that, after an initial exchange of pleasantries, the president used the remainder of the call to advance his personal interests. Namely, he sought to pressure the Ukrainian leader to take actions to help the president's 2020 re-election bid. According to the White House officials who had direct knowledge of the call, the president pressured Mr. Zelensky to, inter alia, initiate or continue an investigation into the activities of former Vice President Joseph Biden and his son, Hunter Biden. Assist in purportedly uncovering that allegations of Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election originated in Ukraine, with a specific request that the Ukrainian leader locate and turn over servers used by the Democratic National Committee, DNC, and examined by the U.S. cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike, which initially reported that Russian hackers had penetrated the DNC's networks in 2016, and meet or speak with two people the president named explicitly as his personal envoys on these matters, Mr. Giuliani and Attorney General Barr, to whom the president referred multiple times in tandem. 1. Apart from the information in the enclosure, it is my belief that none of the information contained herein meets the definition of classified information outlined in Executive Order 13526, Part 1, Section 1.1. There is ample open source information about the efforts I describe below, including statements by the President and Mr. Giuliani. In addition, based on my personal observations, there is discretion with respect to the classification of private comments by or instructions from the President, including his communications with foreign leaders. Information that is not related to U.S. foreign policy or national security, such as the information contained in this document, when separated from the enclosure, is generally treated as unclassified. I also believe that applying a classification marking to this information would violate Executive Order 13526, Part 1, Section 1.7, which states, "In no case shall information be classified, continue to be maintained as classified, or fail to be declassified in order to, 1, conceal violations of law, inefficiency, or administrative error, or 2, prevent embarrassment to a person, organization, or agency. 2. It is unclear whether such a Ukrainian investigation exists. See footnote number 7 for additional information. 3. I do not know why the President associates these servers with Ukraine. See, for example, his comments to Fox News on 20 July. Quote, "And Ukraine, take a look at Ukraine. How come the FBI didn't take this server? Podesta told them to get out. He said get out. So how come the FBI didn't take the server from the DNC? The President also praised Ukraine's Prosecutor General, Mr. Yuri Lutsenko, and suggested that Mr. Zelensky might want to keep him in his position. Note, starting in March 2019, Mr. Lutsenko made a series of public allegations, many of which he later walked back, about the Biden family's activities in Ukraine, Ukrainian officials' purported involvement in the 2016 U.S. election, and the activities of the U.S. Embassy in Kiev. See Part 4 for additional context. The White House officials who told me this information were deeply disturbed by what had transpired in the phone call. They told me that there was already a discussion ongoing with White House lawyers about how to treat the call because of the likelihood, in the officials' retelling, that they had witnessed the President abuse his office for personal gain. The Ukrainian side was the first to publicly acknowledge the phone call. On the evening of 25 July, a readout was posted on the website of the Ukrainian president that contained the following line, translation from original Russian language readout. Donald Trump expressed his conviction that the new Ukrainian government will be able to quickly improve Ukraine's image and complete the investigation of corruption cases that have held back cooperation between Ukraine and the United States. Aside from the above-mentioned cases purportedly dealing with the Biden family and the 2016 U.S. election, I was told by White House officials that no other cases were discussed. Based on my understanding, there were approximately a dozen White House officials who listened to the call, a mixture of policy officials and duty officers in the White House Situation Room, as is customary. The officials I spoke with told me that participation in the call had not been restricted in advance, because everyone expected it would be a routine call with a foreign leader. I do not know whether anyone was physically present with the President during the call. In addition to White House personnel, I was told that a State Department official, Mr. T. Ulrich Breckbuhl, also listened in on the call. I was not the only non-White House official to receive a readout of the call. Based on my understanding, multiple State Department and intelligence community officials were also briefed on the contents of the call, as outlined above. 2. Efforts to restrict access to records related to the call. In the days following the phone call, I learned from multiple U.S. officials that senior White House officials had intervened to lock down all records of the phone call, especially the official word-for-word transcript of the call that was produced, as is customary, by the White House Situation Room. This set of actions underscored to me that White House officials understood the gravity of what had transpired in the call. White House officials told me that they were directed by White House lawyers to remove the electronic transcript from the computer system in which such transcripts are typically stored for coordination, finalization, and distribution to cabinet-level officials. Instead, the transcript was loaded into a separate electronic system, that is otherwise used to store and handle classified information of an especially sensitive nature. One White House official described this act as an abuse of this electronic system because the call did not contain anything remotely sensitive from a national security perspective. I do not know whether similar measures were taken to restrict access to other records of the call, such as contemporaneous handwritten notes taken by those who listened in. 3. Ongoing concerns. On 26 July, a day after the call, U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations, Kurt Volker, visited Kyiv and met with President Zelensky and a variety of Ukrainian political figures. Ambassador Volker was accompanied in his meetings by U.S. Ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland. Based on multiple readouts of these meetings recounted to me by various U.S. officials, Ambassadors Volker and Sondland reportedly provided advice to the Ukrainian leadership about how to navigate the demands that the president had made of Mr. Zelensky. I also learned from multiple U.S. officials that, on or about 2 August, Mr. Giuliani reportedly traveled to Madrid to meet with one of President Zelensky's advisors, Andrei Yermak. The U.S. officials characterized this meeting, which was not reported publicly at the time, as a direct follow-up to the president's call with Mr. Zelensky about the cases they had discussed. Separately, multiple U.S. officials told me that Mr. Giuliani had reportedly privately reached out to a variety of other Zelensky advisors, including Chief of Staff Andrei Bodin and Acting Chairman of the Security Service of Ukraine, Ivan Bakanov. I do not know whether those officials met or spoke with Mr. Giuliani, but I was told separately by multiple U.S. officials that Mr. Yermak and Mr. Bakanov intended to travel to Washington in mid-August. On 9 August, the president told reporters, quote, "I think President Zelensky is going to make a deal with President Putin, and he will be invited to the White House, and we look forward to seeing him. He's already been invited to the White House, and he wants to come, and I think he will. He's a very reasonable guy. He wants to see peace in Ukraine, and I think he will be coming very soon, actually." 4. Circumstances leading up to the 25 July presidential phone call. Beginning in late March 2019, a series of articles appeared in an online publication called The Hill. In these articles, several Ukrainian officials, most notably Prosecutor General Yuri Lutsenko, made a series of allegations against other Ukrainian officials and current and former U.S. officials. Mr. Lutsenko and his colleagues alleged, inter alia. 4. In a report published by the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, OCCRP, on 22 July, two associates of Mr. Giuliani reportedly traveled to Kyiv in May 2019 and met with Mr. Bakanov and another close Zelensky advisor, Mr. Sergei Shafir. Mr. Lutsenko and his colleagues alleged, inter alia, that they possessed evidence that Ukrainian officials, namely head of the National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine, Artem Sitnik, and Member of Parliament Sergei Lyshenko, had interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, allegedly in collaboration with the DNC and the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv. 5. Mr. Sitnik and Mr. Lyshenko are two of Mr. Lutsenko's main domestic rivals. Mr. Lutsenko has no legal training and has been widely criticized in Ukraine for politicizing criminal probes and using his tenure as prosecutor general to protect corrupt Ukrainian officials. He has publicly feuded with Mr. Sitnik, who heads Ukraine's only competent anti-corruption body, and with Mr. Lyshenko, a former investigative journalist who has repeatedly criticized Mr. Lutsenko's record. In December 2018, a Ukrainian court upheld a complaint by a member of parliament, Mr. Borislav Rosenblatt, who alleged that Mr. Sitnik and Mr. Lyshenko had interfered in the 2016 U.S. election by publicizing a document detailing corrupt payments made by former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych before his ouster in 2014. Mr. Rosenblatt had originally filed the motion in late 2017 after attempting to flee Ukraine amid an investigation into his taking of a large bribe. On 16 July 2019, Mr. Lyshenko publicly stated that a Ukrainian court had overturned the lower court's decision. Mr. Lutsenko and his colleagues alleged that the U.S. Embassy in Kiev, specifically U.S. Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, who had criticized Mr. Lutsenko's organization for its poor record on fighting corruption, had allegedly obstructed Ukrainian law enforcement agencies' pursuit of corruption cases, including by providing a do-not-prosecute list, and had blocked Ukrainian prosecutors from traveling to the United States, expressly to prevent them from delivering their evidence about the 2016 U.S. election. 6. Mr. Lutsenko later told Ukrainian news outlet The Babel on 17 April that Ambassador Yovanovitch had never provided such a list, and that he was, in fact, the one who requested such a list. And that former Vice President Biden had pressured former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko in 2016 to fire then-Ukrainian Prosecutor General Viktor Shokin in order to quash a purported criminal probe into Burisma Holdings, a Ukrainian energy company on whose board the former Vice President's son, Hunter, sat. 7. Mr. Lutsenko later told Bloomberg on 16 May that former Vice President Biden and his son were not subject to any current Ukrainian investigations, and that he had no evidence against them. Other senior Ukrainian officials also contested his original allegations. One former senior Ukrainian prosecutor told Bloomberg on 7 May that Mr. Shokin, in fact, was not investigating Burisma at the time of his removal in 2016. In several public comments, Mr. Lutsenko also stated that he wished to communicate directly with Attorney General Barr on these matters. 8. See, for example, Mr. Lutsenko's comments to The Hill on 1 and 7 April, and his interview with The Babel on 17 April, in which he stated that he had spoken with Mr. Giuliani about arranging contact with Attorney General Barr. 9. In May, Attorney General Barr announced that he was initiating a probe into the origins of the Russia investigation. According to the above-referenced OCCRP report, 22 July, two associates of Mr. Giuliani claimed to be working with Ukrainian officials to uncover information that would become part of this inquiry. In an interview with Fox News on 8 August, Mr. Giuliani claimed that Mr. John Durham, whom Attorney General Barr designated to lead this probe, was, quote, spending a lot of time in Europe because he was investigating Ukraine. I do not know the extent to which, if at all, Mr. Giuliani is directly coordinating his efforts on Ukraine with Attorney General Barr or Mr. Durham. The allegations of Mr. Lutsenko came on the eve of the first round of Ukraine's presidential election on 31 March. By that time, Mr. Lutsenko's political patron, President Poroshenko, was trailing Mr. Zelensky in the polls and appeared likely to be defeated. Mr. Zelensky had made known his desire to replace Mr. Lutsenko as prosecutor general. On 21 April, Mr. Poroshenko lost the runoff to Mr. Zelensky by a landslide. See enclosure for additional information. It was also publicly reported that Mr. Giuliani had met on at least two occasions with Mr. Lutsenko, once in New York in late January, and again in Warsaw in mid-February. In addition, it was publicly reported that Mr. Giuliani had spoken in late 2018 to former Prosecutor General Shokin in a Skype call arranged by two associates of Mr. Giuliani. 10. See, for example, the above-referenced articles in Bloomberg, 16 May, and OCCRP, 22 July. On 25 April, in an interview with Fox News, the president called Mr. Lutsenko's claims big and incredible, and stated that the attorney general would want to see this. On or about 29 April, I learned from U.S. officials with direct knowledge of the situation that Ambassador Yovanovitch had been suddenly recalled to Washington by senior State Department officials for consultations and would most likely be removed from her position. Around the same time, I also learned from a U.S. official that associates of Mr. Giuliani were trying to make contact with the incoming Zelensky team. 11. I do not know whether these associates of Mr. Giuliani were the same individuals named in the 22 July report by OCCRP, referenced above. On 6 May, the State Department announced that Ambassador Yovanovitch would be ending her assignment in Kiev as planned. However, several U.S. officials told me that, in fact, her tour was curtailed because of pressure stemming from Mr. Lutsenko's allegations. Mr. Giuliani subsequently stated in an interview with a Ukrainian journalist, published on 14 May, that Ambassador Yovanovitch was, quote, removed because she was part of the efforts against the president. On 9 May, the New York Times reported that Mr. Giuliani planned to travel to Ukraine to press the Ukrainian government to pursue investigations that would help the president in his 2020 re-election bid. In his multitude of public statements leading up to and in the wake of the publication of this article, Mr. Giuliani confirmed that he was focused on encouraging Ukrainian authorities to pursue investigations into alleged Ukrainian interference in the 2016 U.S. election and alleged wrongdoing by the Biden family. 12. See, for example, Mr. Giuliani's appearance on Fox News on 6 April and his tweets on 23 April and 10 May. In his interview with the New York Times, Mr. Giuliani stated that the president, quote, basically knows what I'm doing, sure, as his lawyer. Mr. Giuliani also stated, quote, we're not meddling in an election, we're meddling in an investigation, which we have a right to do. There's nothing illegal about it. Somebody could say it's improper, and this isn't foreign policy. I'm asking them to do an investigation that they're doing already, and that other people are telling them to stop. And I'm going to give them reasons why they shouldn't stop it, because that information will be very, very helpful to my client and may turn out to be helpful to my government. On the afternoon of 10 May, the president stated in an interview with Politico that he planned to speak with Mr. Giuliani about the trip. A few hours later, Mr. Giuliani publicly canceled his trip, claiming that Mr. Zelensky was, quote, surrounded by enemies of the U.S. president and of the United States. On 11 May, Mr. Lutsenko met for 2 hours with President-elect Zelensky, according to a public account given several days later by Mr. Lutsenko. Mr. Lutsenko publicly stated that he had told Mr. Zelensky that he wished to remain as prosecutor general. Starting in mid-May, I heard from multiple U.S. officials that they were deeply concerned by what they viewed as Mr. Giuliani's circumvention of national security decision-making processes to engage with Ukrainian officials and relay messages back and forth between Kiev and the president. These officials also told me that State Department officials, including Ambassadors Volker and Sondland, had spoken with Mr. Giuliani in an attempt to contain the damage to U.S. national security, and that Ambassadors Volker and Sondland during this time period met with members of the new Ukrainian administration and, in addition to discussing policy matters, sought to help Ukrainian leaders understand and respond to the differing messages they were receiving from official U.S. channels, on the one hand, and from Mr. Giuliani, on the other. During this same time frame, multiple U.S. officials told me that the Ukrainian leadership was led to believe that a meeting or phone call between the president and President Zelensky would depend on whether Zelensky showed willingness to play ball on the issues that had been publicly aired by Mr. Lutsenko and Mr. Giuliani. Note, this was the general understanding of the state of affairs as conveyed to me by U.S. officials from late May into early July. I do not know who delivered this message to the Ukrainian leadership, or when. See enclosure for additional information. Shortly after President Zelensky's inauguration, it was publicly reported that Mr. Giuliani met with two other Ukrainian officials. Ukraine's special anti-corruption prosecutor, Mr. Nazar Kolodnitsky, and a former Ukrainian diplomat named Andrei Telesenko. Both Mr. Kolodnitsky and Mr. Telesenko are allies of Mr. Lutsenko and made similar allegations in the above-mentioned series of articles in The Hill. On 13 July, the president told ABC's George Stephanopoulos that he would accept damaging information on his political rivals from a foreign government. On 21 June, Mr. Giuliani tweeted, "New Prez of Ukraine still silent on investigation of Ukrainian interference in 2016 and alleged Biden bribery of Poroshenko. Time for leadership and investigate both if you want to purge how Ukraine was abused by Hillary and Clinton people." In mid-July, I learned of a sudden change of policy with respect to U.S. assistance for Ukraine. See enclosure for additional information. Enclosure, Classified Appendix. August 12, 2019. U, Classified Appendix. U, Supplementary Classified Information is provided as follows. U, Additional Information related to Section 2. According to multiple White House officials I spoke with, the transcript of the president's call with President Zelensky was placed into a computer system managed directly by the National Security Council, NSC, Directorate for Intelligence Programs. This is a standalone computer system reserved for code word level intelligence information, such as covert action. According to information I received from White House officials, some officials voiced concerns internally that this would be an abuse of the system and was not consistent with the responsibilities of the Directorate for Intelligence Programs. According to White House officials I spoke with, this was not the first time, under this administration, that a presidential transcript was placed into this code word level system solely for the purpose of protecting politically sensitive, rather than national security sensitive, information. U. Additional information related to Section 4. Information relating to classified intelligence community reporting and analysis, redacted. I would like to expand upon two issues mentioned in Section 4 that might have a connection with the overall effort to pressure the Ukrainian leadership. As I do not know definitively whether the below-mentioned decisions are connected to the broader efforts I describe, I have chosen to include them in the classified annex. If they indeed represent genuine policy deliberations and decisions formulated to advance U.S. foreign policy and national security, one might be able to make a reasonable case that the facts are classified. I learned from U.S. officials that, on or around 14 May, the president instructed Vice President Pence to cancel his planned travel to Ukraine to attend President Zelensky's inauguration on 20 May. Secretary of Energy Rick Perry led the delegation instead. According to these officials, it was also made clear to them that the president did not want to meet with Mr. Zelensky until he saw how Zelensky chose to act in office. I do not know how this guidance was communicated or by whom. I also do not know whether this action was connected with the broader understanding described in the unclassified letter that a meeting or phone call between the president and President Zelensky would depend on whether Zelensky showed willingness to play ball on the issues that had been publicly aired by Mr. Lutsenko and Mr. Giuliani. On 18 July, an Office of Management and Budget, OMB official, informed departments and agencies that the president, earlier that month, had issued instructions to suspend all U.S. security assistance to Ukraine. Neither OMB nor the NSC staff knew why this instruction had been issued. During interagency meetings on 23 July and 26 July, OMB officials again stated explicitly that the instruction to suspend this assistance had come directly from the president, but they still were unaware of a policy rationale. As of early August, I heard from U.S. officials that some Ukrainian officials were aware that U.S. aid might be in jeopardy, but I do not know how or when they learned of it.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
La Mesa has moved a step closer to providing citizens oversight of its police department, but not as far as many community members had hoped to go. At a city council meeting September 10th, Police Chief Walt Vasquez presented a report on citizen police oversight practices. He recommended appointment of an 11-member citizen public safety panel to exchange information on improving public safety, but the panel would lack investigative powers to examine complaints against the police department. Several members of the public testified against the chief's proposal. Councilwoman Dr. Akilah Weber questioned Chief Vasquez on whether he adequately canvassed residents for input. Calls for a Citizens Oversight or Review Commission arose after a video went viral, showing a La Mesa police officer forcing an unarmed female student to the ground at Helix High School in January 2018. The student recently settled with the city for an undisclosed amount. The city ordered an independent review which found no wrongdoing by police. But council members and the public were dismayed to learn that state law prohibited them from reading the full report, which was provided only to the police chief. Mayor Mark Rapostathis agreed on the need for transparency and more public input. He said the city needs to cast a wider net to get everyone's perspectives on oversight. A key stumbling block is that in general law cities, such as La Mesa, police oversight is vested in the chief, unlike in many charter cities. Councilman Baber said one option would be to change the state law. Given that Councilwoman Weber's mother is Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who has authored major police reform bills signed into law, a legislative fix could happen. Councilwoman Christine Alicio acknowledged frustration in the community. She said the chief was trying to create, quote, the functional equivalent of what the citizens are asking for. Ultimately, the City Council agreed to the composition of the public safety panel proposed by the chief with two changes, the youth slot going to a high school student, and a member of the Police Officer Association will fill one of the two slots formerly allocated to the business community. Rather than being responsible for police oversight, the group will survey the community for input, analyze other similarly sized general law cities, then establish its own recommendation for the City Council in consultation with the chief, lawyers, and the public. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
An E. coli outbreak has been traced to gold medal unbleached flour, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration warns. General Mills has recalled 5-pound bags of the flour, which have a use-by date of September 6, 2020. Check your pantry and flour canisters, and if you have any gold medal unbleached flour, throw it away. Or return it to the store for a refund if you still have the receipt and packaging. Gold Mills asks consumers who purchase the unbleached flour affected to call their customer relations team at 800-230-8103. This strain of E. coli is more severe than most and causes not only infection but also releases toxins into the body, according to health officials at Johns Hopkins Medical Center. This can cause abdominal pain, bloody diarrhea, kidney damage, or even death in extreme cases. If you become ill with E. coli symptoms after consuming gold medal flour, contact your doctor immediately. Prompt treatment is important, which may include antibiotics and IV fluids, or even dialysis to remove the toxin from the kidneys and blood, if kidney damage has occurred. There have been several recalls recently of various brands of flour and products containing flour, including a recall of Trusted Source flour earlier this year that sickened 21 people. The flour may have been contaminated from wheat crops exposed to bacteria, such as in fecal matter from animals in the field. Flour is not customarily treated to kill bacteria when harvested or milled, since traditionally the risk has been low. The FDA now advises consumers to avoid any raw flour, such as in cookie dough, and wash your hands after baking any foods made with flour. Even though cooking at high heat can kill the bacteria, health officials recommend not doing so to avoid risks of handling or eating undercooked food that is contaminated. The risk is especially high for older adults, young children, and people with compromised immune systems. The current recall affects only gold medal unbleached flour in 5-pound bags with that September 6, 2020 expiration date. The E. coli was found during routine inspecting and other gold medal flour products are believed safe, according to the company. If you have any questions, you can call General Mills at 1-800-230-8103. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Gerald Stevenson.
Kaiser Permanente and over 80,000 union workers have reached a tentative contract settlement. If ratified by workers in the coming weeks, the 4-year agreement between Kaiser and 7 unions would avert a nationwide strike that was scheduled to begin on October 14th. The settlement covers a broad range of workers, ranging from x-ray technicians to nurses. According to an announcement sent by a coalition of Kaiser unions, the agreement includes a joint effort to revitalize the worker management partnership, a groundbreaking workforce development program providing opportunities for thousands of workers to receive a free education to help fill an unexpected shortage of hundreds of thousands of licensed healthcare jobs with a culturally appropriate workforce. Kaiser will provide $130 million in funding for the program. Annual raises of 3% over the next 4 years for workers in California, with slightly different levels of raises in other states. Full protection of retirement benefits for current and future employees. A ban on subcontracting, stronger restrictions on outsourcing, and more. Workers had been without a contract since last year, before voting to strike. The unions had blasted Kaiser for having profits higher than the vast majority of Fortune 500 companies, and for paying hefty executive salaries while skimping on compensation for workers and raising healthcare premiums for members. Kaiser spokesperson Arlene Piesnall says the agreement is a testament to the dedication, compassion, and skill that its employees bring to work every day, and demonstrates that Kaiser Permanente and the coalition have a, quote, shared commitment to affordability for our members, the Sacramento Bee reports. Georgette Bradford, an ultrasound technician at Kaiser, says reaching an agreement was not easy. It had lots of twists and turns, she concludes, but in the end, we accomplished what we set out to do, reach an agreement that is good for patients, workers, and our communities. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Paul Cruz with his Crime Beat Report. The 4th District Court of Appeals has ruled that sexually violent predator Alvin Quarles must remain locked up in a state mental hospital while appellate court judges review the case. The appellate court's stay blocks an earlier decision by Superior Court Judge David Gill, who had approved a supervised release of Quarles into a community within San Diego County. Quarles was slated to be released into a home in Hacumba Hot Springs, supervised by Liberty Healthcare, until the property owner withdrew the offer. A new location had not been found when Gill issued his order. San Diego District Attorney Summer Stepan filed an appeal of Gill's decision to release Quarles, and now the appellate court has granted the stay that Stepan sought. Quarles was charged with over 50 rapes and other crimes in the 1980s before pleading guilty to 4 rapes and other felonies. He was dubbed the bolder-than-most rapist because he forced husbands and boyfriends to watch as he sexually assaulted their female partners. Quarles' release has been opposed by several of his past victims as well as by supervisor Diane Jacob. His attorneys have until September 30th to respond to the appellate court's decision.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.